Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the business leader Inga Beale. She runs Lloyd's of London, the first ever woman to hold the post in the insurer's 328-year history. Measuring risk is her specialist skill and has taken her to the very top of her profession. But it's tempting to think it served her pretty well in her personal life too. 8 years ago, having invested a lifetime's hard work in the highly traditional male-dominated world of insurance, she took a chance and came out as bisexual. In years gone by, that might well have crippled a career. Instead, her timing and temerity only burnished her reputation. She's been hailed as a refreshing force in a business world striving to become accessible and relevant. She says inclusion is the foundation of innovation, and having an open, accepting and diverse workforce will enable us to succeed in a changing and challenging world. So welcome, Inga Beale. Highly accomplished, doubtless very, very hardworking, and yet you are, I guess, the poster girl for diversity. I wonder how that feels.
That feels like there's a lot of pressure on me, I have to admit, but it's a wonderful pressure. And I've been working in insurance for 34 years, and never, ever did I imagine when I started out in the 80s that I would reach a position like this, that I could be such a role model. And when I started, I didn't have any female role models. And I just think, gosh, how my life might have been different if I had. And now here I am. I can be one of those. And it actually feels fantastic.
And the pressure then comes from being expected not just to perform in your job, not just to be very, very good, but also to have opinions, to give speeches, to talk about your personal life in a public forum. Is that the pressure?
Yes, the pressure is about being, being very public about it and continuing to have the courage to talk openly about topics that are quite difficult, and particularly when you're running such a global business. Because, of course, attitudes and views are very different all around the world. So you've always got that pressure on how far can I go, what's appropriate to say in this environment. But I also have a challenging job.
Yes.
Lloyd's is a fantastic place. It's steeped in history. But in order for it to be around for at least another 328 years, we've got to modernise the place. So I've got a really big, tough day job to do, as well as trying to talk about and open up people's minds to a much more inclusive environment.
I hope you don't take offence at this, but most people don't get very excited about insurance. What are we missing?
Well, I started off as a trainee underwriter and I was in a global environment. So one moment I was looking at something from Chile, the next thing I was looking at something from Australia, then I was moving to Japan. And I know we see dreadful scenes of awful catastrophes around the world, and they are, and it's so tragic to see loss of life. But when you think that actually we can help put people's lives back together, because that's our job, when something goes wrong, we're there to support them, fund rebuilding their lives, rebuilding towns, cities, countries, that makes you feel very, very good.
Tell me about your first piece of music. What are we going to hear?
My first piece of music is Respect by Aretha Franklin.
And why have you chosen this?
I think what she did with this song was empower women. And that's a lot about what I like to do and what I'm sort of seeking to do. Very impactful, sort of took a song a bit about, I suppose, sex and love and turned it into quite a political movement.
Oh!
That was Aretha Franklin and Respect. So, Inga Beale, it was 325 years before a woman was appointed to run Lloyd's of London. It was 1973 before a woman was even allowed to be a broker at Lloyd's. How would you characterise the culture in the city today for women?
It's changed dramatically since I've been working. It really has. It's a very, very different feel to it now. But there are still behaviours that go on that mean that if you, sometimes you just don't feel you fit in. You can't have the same, perhaps, laddish conversations. And it doesn't just mean for women, and women might feel excluded. It's all types of other behaviours that people perhaps, they don't associate themselves with. And so when you've got a lot of people together who all behave in the same way and have this, you know, the same thoughts, which is what's happened over the sort of centuries, if you like, they all sort of club together. That's normal for them. So then when someone comes in who's a little bit different, you just don't fit in.
You've got a workforce yourself of about 800 people. When you are recruiting for senior roles, how much do you yourself consider somebody's ethnicity, religion or their sexuality or their potential disability? Does it come into your mind?
Well, what we're trying to do, of course, is block out that unconscious bias.
Very, very difficult.
Yes, but we all fall into the trap. So I was just as guilty. When I was running a team in the city in the 90s, this was a trading environment, and the broker walked in one day and he said, "Oh, I got the short straw today. I got told I had to come and see the Spice Girls." So I'm looking at him saying, "What do you mean?" And he says, "Look," and I realise I've got five women there and we've done exactly the same. We've fallen into the trap of being a little club because we have some sort of affinity. We feel comfortable with each other. So what I do now is I've learnt the hard way, say, right, now we've got to try and banish those unconscious biases. Think much more openly and say, right, is this person any good? Are they the right fit and will they do a good job?
And so should it be to do with targets being imposed from the outside, or do we leave it up to the individual businesses to take that responsibility themselves? And do we punish them if they don't?
Well, there is a lot of debate around quotas, targets and then punishment. All I can say, and we're not going out with any particular firm view in the market at the moment, but I was very, very lucky to work for an organisation that had targets set for its managers to promote women. And I benefited from that. I didn't know it at the time, but when I said no to the very first promotion I was offered, because I didn't think I had the confidence, a very senior woman came and sat with me and said, "Inga, why did you not take the job?" And I said, I can't do it. I'm not good enough. I had absolutely no confidence. I was part of a specific program to promote women, and she was determined to get me to take that promotion.
Something else you've said that strikes me as very interesting previously is that you've said there's evidence that productivity is 30% lower among workers who hide their identity. Now, where's your proof for that? That's a bold statement.
Well, there is some analysis that's been done, but I personally suffered with that myself. When I was first with a woman, this was in the days no mobile telephones, so any phone call went through the receptionist.
Yes.
And I worked for quite a small firm at the time. I told my partner, "You cannot phone me in the office," because I was so fearful that if she kept phoning me, people would be suspicious. Now, how ridiculous is that? That meant there was a whole part of me that was sort of left outside, and I felt I always had to de-genderise everything I was saying. And if you're constantly trying to be on the guard, being careful what you say, that affects actually how engaged you can be at work. And the most productive teams and the most successful teams, particularly if you're going into new areas, new markets, are diverse teams. You need the challenge. No CEO knows all the answers for a business.
More music, Inga Beale. Tell me about this.
My father always played the piano at home. I used to love it, and I begged him to give me piano lessons. And at age 7, I started learning to play the piano. And one of the songs that he used to sing and play was "There Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens." And it was one of the first songs when I was good enough, I learnt to play, and I used to sing it out loud. And it just reminds me fondly of my father.
One night Farmer Brown was taking the air, locked up the barnyard with the greatest of care.
Down in the hen house, something stirred when he shouted, "Who's there?" This is what he heard. "There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble with your chin. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. You're stomping around and shaking the ground. You're kicking up an awful dust. We chickens trying to sleep and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble. It's a sin. Tomorrow is a busy day. We got things to do. We got eggs to lay. We got ground to dig and worms to scratch. It takes a lot of setting, getting chicks to hatch. Oh,
that was Louis Jordan and "There Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens." You chose that, Ingabiel, because you say it was the first song that your father taught you to play on piano, and you sang it for many years. Were you something of a daddy's girl? Were you close to your dad?
Oh, yes, I was very much daddy's girl.
Were you?
I have an older brother and a younger sister, and they both had blonde hair, and I was the middle child, and I had dark hair. So from a very early age, I always felt I was the odd one out. And my brother and sister, possibly because of the age difference between them, were much closer. And when my sister was born, my brother was a bit older. So my brother and sister, I felt at the time, were very, very close. And they used to actually tell me that I was adopted because of the colour of my hair. So I sort of then attached myself to my father. And I was always accompanying my father to things. He had some vintage cars. I used to be in the garage with him, helping him as he was tinkering away. They were buying my sister a guinea pig for her birthday. Somebody needed to help Dad build the hutch. I was that person. I was the one who was with my dad. I would accompany him to the school library. He was the school librarian. I was always doing things with my father.
And was it quite a liberal household? I get that impression from stuff that I've read.
Yes, my father, I suppose, he was a little bit of a rebel, I think, when he was younger. He never quite wanted to behave, so he actually went to Oxford University. But then the first thing he did for a job was he worked for Marley Tiles, and he was a roofer. So he always had this sort of feeling in him sometimes that he didn't quite want to conform to things. Now, I think I've picked a little bit of that up.
I think you might have, Inga.
Yes. But it made him actually, he was also very, very, very liberal. And he actually fell in love with Scandinavia during the war because he was posted in Finland during the war. And he met his first wife in Finland, married her, brought her back to England. That didn't last. And then he was so enthralled by Scandinavians that he was a member of the Scandinavian Society at Oxford. My mother came over as a student from Norway. He met her at one of their events, chased her down and persuaded her to come back and said, "Come and marry me and come and move to England."
Tell me about your next piece of music then, and indeed why you've chosen it.
Yes, my mother coming from Norway meant Norwegian things were very much part of our life at home. And every year we went to Norway on holiday to meet all the rest of our family. She died in 2009, and we wanted to reflect that Norwegian ancestry. So this is a piece from Grieg's Peer Gynt, and it's called Morning Mood.
That was Morning Mood from Grieg's Peer Gynt, played there by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Vernon Handley. Social mobility remains well, stubbornly intransigent here in the UK. Most of the people who get the top jobs, and as a result, most of the people who earn most, have been private school educated. You went to a state school. What was it you were learning there, Inga Beale, that made a difference to your outlook and your ambitions, do you think?
Well, I went to an all-girls school, or it was at the time when I started. However, I was rather a rebel. So after about 11 or 12, I didn't study very hard. And so for me, it's quite difficult to actually say that the school itself had a big impact on me.
And the rebel would mean what? Not doing homework or not turning up at class?
I never played truant. But in my first year, we had our exams. And I was pretty good at French. But I came second in the class. And I think I scored something like 96%. And my father was a teacher at the sort of parallel school, the boys' grammar school, and he was a language teacher. He spoke many languages. And when we had the results come out, the teacher said, oh, well, Caroline, I think her name was Caroline, she got 98%, she was first. Inga was second with 96%. Unfortunate, isn't it, Inga, because you should have been first, because, of course, your dad would have been much prouder. And she said something like that to me.
Ooh.
And it gave me I had such an adverse reaction. And from then on, it was quite difficult for me to, work hard at school. It had a profound impact on me.
And the impact was what? You felt angry at her for presuming to make such a statement, or you felt worried that you would have disappointed your dad? Well,
I would not have worried about disappointing my dad, because my mother and father were very, very supportive. I was so angry that I thought I had done really, really, really well, and she'd basically told me I hadn't.
Let's go to your next piece of music, Inga Beale. We're going to hear your fourth. Tell me about this.
So when I was a teenager, I got in with a group of friends. And many of them were not at school, so I might have been 14, 15, 16, but I was with friends who were much older and had already left school. And I got big time into reggae. And I had some friends who played in a reggae band. It was white reggae. In Newbury at that time, there weren't terribly many black faces around, so we were all white, but we played in this reggae band. We loved the music. And I used to listen to Bob Marley incessantly in those days. So I've chosen a Bob Marley track, which is Could You Be Loved?
That was Bob Marley and Could You Be Loved? Inga Beale, you didn't go to university, but you did start a job as a very junior underwriter. Just describe to me, not the job, but the office culture.
That was in the early 80s. In 82, I started. Now, having not had any money, really, up until then, and suddenly you're in the city and you're earning. So you suddenly had all this money, and it was so exciting. And you were looking at fascinating risks from all over the world. It was a very male culture. And I was, at one time, I was one female out of 35 underwriters. And I started to behave very much like them because I wanted to fit in.
Which meant doing what? What sort of things?
Going to the pub and having to drink with them the same drinks that they were drinking. Things like that. And I did start to play rugby. It wasn't because of the male behaviour. I just happened to get into rugby. But it did enable you to be thought of as quite strong and tough. And they would often talk about me being a rugby player. You know, you don't want to mess with her. So in a way, it sort of helped me feel that I actually belong to this very male society.
Tell me about your next piece of music. We're on your fifth disc of the day.
Yes. So in the late 80s, I was working in this very male chauvinistic environment in the city. And one day a particularly sexist thing happened and I decided to quit.
Oh, come on. What was it?
Well, we were hosting in the office, we were hosting a series of cocktail parties for the cricket that was going on in the West Indies. And the manager's wife worked for the Jamaican Tourist Board, and she'd managed to get all these posters for Jamaica. And at that time, you can imagine what they were. There was a woman in a bikini. There was a woman in a bikini with a wet T-shirt. There was a woman with no bikini but a wet T-shirt. So we had them all around, and we were having a series of cocktail parties celebrating the cricket. And after about 3 weeks, the posters were still up on the walls, and I went into my manager and I said, I really think you should take them down now. I think I've been really, you know, really good sport. And he said, yes, Inga, we'll do that immediately. The next day I came in, I walked around the corner and saw my desk, and my desk was wrapped up in the posters. And I thought, oh, this isn't for me. And I turned around and I walked out. And then I disappeared for 3 days. And then I finally told my manager, I can't do it anymore, I'm leaving. So I left the city, bought a round-the-world ticket, didn't know what I was really going to do. And before I left, a dear friend of mine, he made a cassette tape and put a lot of music on for me. And this piece of music I used to play a lot as I was travelling on my own all around the world. And I so sort of imagined that one day I would come home and really be loved by somebody. So this is called A Man Is In Love by the Waterboys.
A man is in love. How did I guess? I figured it out while he was watching you dress. He'd give you his all if you but agree. A man is in love and he's me.
A Man Is In Love, the Waterboys. You said, Inga Beale, that was on your cassette tape. Remember those? So you bought the ticket. As you say, you didn't have a travel itinerary and you didn't have any money. So you had to get jobs on the way.
Yes, so a really important part of that trip was working for the BBC, as it happens, in Sydney. Every day in Sydney, they used to have a place you could go very early in the morning, and they would hand out jobs on a, you know, first come, first serve basis. And I went there one morning and I got offered, the BBC need a receptionist. So I sat in the BBC's office in Sydney as a receptionist. And interestingly, at that time, the manager of the office was a woman. And of course, that was quite alien to me, having come from the city here in London. And the most important thing was she was respected as the manager. Nobody made a comment that she was a woman. She wore trousers to the office. And there she was, and she was herself, and she was confident. And I just thought, wow, look at this. Look what you can achieve. This is incredible. She totally inspired me. Came back, and I ended up back in insurance.
And you progressed through insurance. By the time of the 90s, you were at a company called GE Solutions. And you said to me earlier, you know, at one point you had turned down promotion when it was offered to you. That was the company you turned down promotion at, I think. Am I right about that?
That was at GE, yes.
Yeah, so you see, I can't imagine you not being confident enough to accept a promotion. What did you think when you were offered this promotion?
I was petrified. There was no way I felt that I was equipped or good enough, actually, to do the job. So I did have this mentor who came along and she spoke to me, and I said, well, maybe I just need a confidence building course. So I went on a week's course called Assertiveness for Women. One of the exercises we had to do, and I remember it quite vividly, they asked you to take all these magazines and in silence on your own, cut out pictures from magazines, newspapers, and build a collage of how you viewed yourself. And I can remember putting pictures on there, making me out to be some ice queen, untouchable, unapproachable. And yet, when we then had the feedback from each other as to how they all perceived you, everyone had a completely different perception of me than I did of myself. They gave you some ideas about how to dress for success. I mean, it sounds a bit corny, but I honestly, it had a profound impact on my life. And I came out of there feeling like a different person.
Did you?
Yeah. Felt like $1 million. I felt like I could do anything. I went straight into the manager's office and said, I'll take the job, thank you.
More music, Inga Beale. Tell me about this, your sixth.
Yes, so I'm someone who's not terribly good at routines. I'm not very good at going to see a film for the second time, let alone a third time. But this musical grabbed my attention like nothing else. It was the Queen musical, We Will Rock You, and I saw it 3 times in London, and then I even saw it a 4th time when I was living in Zurich. We went along to see it. It was actually all in German, and it was the most disappointing experience. But nonetheless, there were some fantastic, uplifting songs in there, and the one I've chosen is called Don't Stop Me Now.
And the world is turning inside out, yeah, floating around in ecstasy, so
if I could just
don't stop me now.
I don't mean to, it's just that I need to add...
Don't stop me, cause I'm having a good time.
From the original London cast recording of the musical We Will Rock You, that was Queen's Don't Stop Me Now. Inga Beale, it was 2008 then when you made the decision to come out at work. Why then?
I was going for a new job and I decided that I'd had enough of having this dual life, and that actually not only was it not fair on me, but it certainly wasn't fair on my partner. And I remember when we moved to Kansas City, that was way before 2008. The state there did not allow same-sex, they didn't recognise same-sex relationships. So my partner had to come in as a student. So we'd lived a secret for many years. And then I had the opportunity to be interviewed for this new job, and I said, I'm no longer doing this. It's draining, it's exhausting, and it's absolutely not fair on my partner. So I made that decision, and during the very first interview, I told the CEO who was interviewing me, and he didn't bat an eyelid. And I thought, why did I not say it earlier?
You were a high-achieving, highly intelligent woman. Why didn't you say it earlier?
You think people will judge you. But I think it was more the fear of the unknown. I mean, you just didn't know what would happen to you. There weren't role models. There wasn't somebody there, already working there, who was out, that I thought, well, look what they're doing. Look how successful they've been. It hasn't harmed them. There was nobody for me to see in that position. So I was so fearful of what the repercussions could be.
In October last year, you topped a power list of the world's leading 100 LGBT executives. You are now married to a man. How important is it that people who interact with you know your backstory? Because you would present as an entirely sort of typical heterosexual couple. There you are with your husband.
Yes. I suppose being in this position, though, I don't often meet people who don't know about my past.
Okay.
So it is quite well known. Would we bring it up in conversation the first time we meet strangers? Probably not, actually. It's not something that we sort of constantly talk about between us. My husband, I mean, he's an artist. He's very different to me. He's not in the business world. But it isn't like a topic that worries us or concerns us or gets in the way. We just get on with life. And I think that's what's important.
Individually, have you found yourself, since you came out and you lived a more honest life in your business life, have you found yourself more productive? Are you better at your job?
Oh, I think I'm much better at my job. Yeah, I really do. It does impact you. If you can bring your whole self to work, and I know there are boundaries, and people have their own levels of what they want to reveal. We all do. We all do with our friends. I mean, it's not just in the workplace. You might tell one thing to one person. You might tell a slightly less full story to another. We all do that all the time, to whatever makes us feel comfortable. But I certainly feel that with not having to have any secrets and not having to disguise where I was at the weekend or who I was with, it's just much more fulfilling, it's more satisfying, and bringing your whole self to work, nothing more invigorating.
Time for some more music, Inga Beale. Tell me about your 7th disc. What's this?
So my husband's from South Africa, and through that I had my very first trip to South Africa, and we went to this amazing restaurant that was right on the beach. The waves were crashing in, the windows were open, we had this fantastic dinner, And then the live music started. And we danced and danced and danced. I don't really remember any of the specific songs that were played, but I've chosen one that reminds me and conjures up wonderful memories of that fantastic evening. And it's Pata Pata by Miriam Makeba.
Miriam Makeba and Pata Pata. Britain's possible exit from the EU is probably the single biggest factor being debated right now here in the UK. Inga, a previous castaway said to me that they were on balance in favour of getting out. Lloyd's position, as I understand it, is firmly in the Remain camp. Why is that?
Lloyd's is a very global business. And nearly 20% of the business that we have in the market comes from continental Europe. And the reason we're able to access that business is because we're part of the EU. So we have automatic passporting rights, and insurance is highly regulated. So you have to be regulated to trade in all of those countries. If we were not to be in the EU, it would mean we'd have to individually negotiate access to those markets. And we can't guarantee that we would have the same rights to do that business. And it's an important part of actually contributing to the GDP of this country.
A little bit more of the personal before we go to your final disc. You've said that, as far as you're concerned, the key to a successful career is, in your words, performance, image and exposure. I wonder if you would also accept that for people like yourself who rise above the crowd, who are highly successful, there is also that key ingredient of a very personal inner drive that gets you there.
Yes, so it's absolutely fascinating, though, because where did it come from? I have absolutely no idea. I just know now that I am very determined, very resilient, and I just want to continue to empower people. There's nothing more fulfilling than seeing other people be successful. And if there's one thing you can do as a CEO, you can form teams, you can give them goals, objectives, and get them to deliver, and then they feel that success. And that is the most fulfilling thing that I see in my job.
Cast away to this island, there will be no team to motivate. There will just be you all on your lonesome. I imagine you'll be fine. What do you think?
I'm not very good on my own. I get a buzz walking through the streets of London because it's so full of people. So I imagine I might struggle a little bit.
More music, Inga Beale. Tell me about your eighth disc. What are we going to hear?
So I made it through to 50 a few years ago, and I was so joyous that I'd made it to 50 and that I was going to have yet another decades more to go. However, I do know that, you know, I'm quite tough. I have to be, I guess, to be in business. And so this song I've chosen because it was typical of how I was feeling at the time. It's called Sweet About Me. When you're playing with desire, don't come running to my place when it burns like sweet about me. Nothing sweet about me. Yeah, sweet about me. Nothing sweet about me. Yeah, sweet about me. Nothing sweet about me. Yeah, sweet about me. Nothing sweet about me. Yeah.
Gabriella Chilmi and Sweet About Me. So Inga Beale, I'm going to give you some books now. You get to take the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to this island. What else are you going to take?
My father loved books, and he was always trying to get me to read them, and I really, really didn't read them. And yet, it was much later in life, and I was in my 20s, I'd left home. I went one day to collect all my books from home, and I started looking through them, and one of them caught my attention. It was The Last of the Mohicans, and it was particularly designed to attract children to it. And I took that on the train one day as I was commuting into the city, and I couldn't put it down. And I thought, why did I not read before? And that book has just stayed in my memory, probably also because of the connection with family and what a lovely, happy childhood I did have, even though I was a rebel.
We'll give you that then. You're allowed a luxury as well.
I do travel a lot with my job. And when I thought about a luxury, I thought, what's the one thing I miss when I'm travelling? And it happens wherever you go outside of the UK. I miss my lovely, warm, sweet cup of milky tea.
So you could have one of those every day, I suppose.
Could I?
Yes, I think you probably could.
Oh, that would be lovely.
And if you had to save one of these 8 discs from the waves, which one would it be, I wonder?
Just one. Patter, patter. Because it would make me keep moving. It's the one there that really gets to my feet and would keep me moving.
It's yours. Inga Beale, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.